Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
If you love to travel, Capital One has a rewards credit card that's perfect for you. With the Capital One Venture X card, you earn unlimited double miles on everything you buy. Plus, you get premium benefits at a collection of luxury hotels when you book on Capital One Travel. And with Venture X, you get access to over 1,000 airport lounges worldwide. Open up a world of travel possibilities with the Capital One Venture X card. What's in your wallet?
Terms apply. Lounge access is subject to change. See CapitalOne.com for details.
Hey everyone, and happy holidays. It's Kendall.
And Josh from Malhar Media.
And as many of you guys know, we just recently launched our foundation, the Higher Hope Foundation. And now we are about to launch our annual matching program for the holiday season. So it's a great time to get involved, to give back, because your gift can go twice as far.
Thanks to all of your support thus far, we've already awarded several grants. We have several more in process, and we've got several exciting projects coming in 2025.
So if you are interested in getting involved and allowing us to do even more projects in the future, it is easier than ever to make a donation. You can do it right on our website, which is higherhope.org. And we've launched a new feature where you can create your own fundraiser. And you can access that by going to the Get Involved tab on our website.
So if you want your gift to be doubled right now through December 27th, Mile High Media will be matching all gifts.
And just as a reminder, 100% of your donations will go directly towards impacting victims of violent crime.
We just want to say a huge thank you in advance to everyone out there for all of your support, your generosity. And there's lots of other ways to help support the foundation. If you're not able to give a gift, just sharing our campaigns, the work that we're doing, just helps get the word out and, you know, helps us further our mission.
Yeah, truly, because of all of your support, so many people are getting the vital services and help that they need. And we're very, very grateful for your continued support. So thank you.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to Mile Higher Podcast. I'm your host, Josh, and I am not joined today by my lovely wife, Kendall, but I am joined by some lovely people still, our producers, Ian and Janelle.
Wow, the lead up to that.
You like that? Yep. Like the anticipation.
Thank you.
So, although it looks like I'm all alone up here, I still have people here with me who support me. No, seriously though, we're recording this episode like 2 weeks before the episode going up because of the holiday week that is here now as you're seeing this. But yeah, Kendall had to work on some stuff for her channel. She's just very tied up with that, which I was like, that's totally fine. You know, I'm going to cover a case that maybe, you know, I find a little bit more interesting. Because it's got some mob ties in Las Vegas, which, you know, I've always found the mob to be a very intriguing criminal enterprise to dig into. Because, I mean, it's just, you watch movies and television and shows and you're like, is this stuff real? Like, is what they depict in these shows and movies actually how it is? And the answer is yes, pretty much. But today we're going to be covering the case of Buffalo Jim Barrier, truly a legend. I mean, a really, really great guy whose life ended way, way too soon. And for this episode, we're going to be heading over to Las Vegas is where this takes place. I was actually born in Las Vegas, fun fact.
Oh, yeah, I forgot you
really?
Were.
Yep, yep. I didn't live there super, super long. I do have memories of it though. I think I was there till I was about 5 or shortly before that I left. But yeah, my birth certificate says Las Vegas, Nevada. And I love Vegas. I mean, even to this day, I love it. I don't know if I would live there full time necessarily, but it is a very cool town, you know, for obvious reasons, right? It's world renowned. I feel like you go anywhere in the world and, you know, people want to hear what about Las Vegas and like what it's like.
It's adults Disneyland.
Yeah, it's an adult playground.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, as many people call it, Sin City. Because of, yeah, there's a lot of legal fun that happens there, but there's a lot of illegal fun that goes on there. And with Buffalo Jim's case, this case is very interesting because A, it's a suspicious death case. And as we dig into it, you'll start seeing why. Because as I mentioned, Buffalo Jim was a legend in Vegas at the time that he lived there. I mean, he was an entertainer. He had a wrestling school. He had a show on TV. I mean, he was working with big name wrestlers back in the day. And he's a dad of four girls, which I love. Just seemed like a really awesome guy. And unfortunately, you know, the mob moved in way before this. They were in Vegas a long time prior to this case, but things really started to get messy when the mob opened up a very, very sketchy strip club called Crazy Horse 2 right next to his wrestling gym and his auto repair shop that he had in the same building. And then things just really spiral from there to the point that we don't know exactly what happened to Buffalo Jim or how he died. We have the official report from the coroner's office. We have very little information from Las Vegas Metro Police, but there is a lot of unanswered questions with this case that, man, I mean, we've been talking off camera about this and still not exactly sure. So I think you'll find this case very interesting, and it's a case that desperately needs to be talked about because his daughters and his family truly believe that he was murdered, and local law enforcement there to this day refuses to take another look at his case because, you know, according to them, he died by other means, and they're going to leave it at that. But there's clear evidence in this case to suggest that he was potentially murdered. And we're gonna dig deep into this one and also give you a lot of context about this time period, about mob ties to Las Vegas, and just how much influence the mob had. Because it's really shocking. It really blew me away when digging into this one, just how much influence they had over Vegas for so long, too. And who knows, even to this day, are they still there? I don't know. But yeah, let's go ahead and just jump right in here to Buffalo Jim. Who is Buffalo Jim? So Buffalo Jim, obviously his nickname, and I'll tell you why he's nicknamed Buffalo Jim. But Jim Barrier was born on March 22nd, 1953, to a working family in Cleveland, Ohio. And we know that his mother was an indigenous Cherokee woman who wanted Jim and his brother to learn about their traditions and take pride in their culture. And he really embodied his heritage. And of course, as you can make the connection there, Buffalo Jim comes from him being a Cherokee. So clearly you can see where Buffalo Jim comes from his culture, his traditions, and that was really what the name he was known by later in life. But as far as Jim's early life, there's very little information out there. There's only quotes from his daughters, stories from his daughters about growing up poor in Ohio. So when Jim was 9, his mother took him on a business trip to Las Vegas. And according to Jim's daughter, Jessica Barrier, he was just absolutely amazed by the glitz and glamour of Vegas. He loved the environment. He also loved the people. It's a great town if you are a character. You know, you're a person with this outward personality, the way that Buffalo Jim dresses. I mean, this guy looks like a rock star / wrestler. You know, he's got this long black hair, beard. He'd wear like a hat with feathers in it. And he'd also wear this really cool like chess piece that was made out of bullet casings, which was awesome. And he'd have like animal bone and stuff. Just a really unique looking individual, absolutely legendary. But he just loved the whole vibe of the town. He loved that, you know, Vegas was originally kind of this country town. He also loved the, you know, the history of Vegas. And, you know, it's kind of this town out, this city out in the West that still kind of has that Wild West vibe to it. You know, if you go down the Fremont Street, you know, you still get a lot of this kind of original Vegas sort of style and look to it, which is really cool. You know, people are walking down the strip in cowboy boots and spurs. And he really felt like it was this upscale Wild West. And he was like, "Mom, when I get older, I'm moving to Vegas." When Jim turned 12, his older brother taught him how to repair cars. And from then on, Jim quit attending school and traveled to gas stations with his brother to fix up vehicles for cash. When he was 18, he saved enough money to purchase a van. And then he's like, "All right, I'm 18. I got a van. I'm headed to Vegas." And what he would do to make money is he would fix cars that were stopped on the highway and like help motorists out, which this is a really cool thing about Buffalo Jim, is that this guy was so selfless and willing to help other people. And throughout his entire life, everybody that knew him was like, this guy would give you the shirt off his back, or whatever you needed, any help that you needed, Buffalo Jim was there. So he'd go and help motorists stopped on the highway and make a little cash that way. When Jim finally arrived in Las Vegas in 1971, he had made enough money to open up Allstate Auto Marine Repairs along Industrial Road in the heart of the city. And his partner in that business was Rick Dahl, who left shortly afterward because Jim refused to cut his beautiful locks. And speaking on Jim in 2008, Rick Dahl said, quote, "Jimmy Barrier believed he had the right to do his own thing. He believed that everyone here has the right to do their own thing," which is so, so true about Vegas. I mean, you can really be yourself in Vegas. And despite, you know, maybe not seeing eye to eye on the business, the two remain lifelong friends. But the big thing, Jim's attitude, it just stuck with people. And he and his business exploded in popularity throughout the 80s and 90s. And soon he had this growing car collection. He even had a lock of Elvis's hair, which is iconic. And he had this beautiful home for his growing family. I mean, his home is epic, right?
Mm-hmm. It's like got columns and it's all, it looks like a Venetian or like ancient Greek style house.
Yeah.
Really beautiful home. Definitely like a very Vegas home.
Absolutely.
Right? It looks like a home you'd find in Vegas. So in the 90s, as Jim's young family grew to include four daughters, he also befriended boxers like Muhammad Ali and wrestlers like Hulk Hogan, The Undertaker, and even Dwayne The Rock Johnson in their early days, which is really cool. In the 90s, he opened up his wrestling school, the Buffalo Wrestling Federation, out of the same complex where he had his auto repair shop. So they're right next door, same building. How convenient. You know, you got your two businesses side by side. I mean, that's a kind of a dream scenario. According to his daughter, Jennifer, the Wrestling Federation was Jim's outlet for mentorship. And according to her, he was just a big kid at heart anyways. And soon, between the wrestling school, celebrity endorsements for his auto shop, and Jim's Friday night public access show called Jim Fights, he became a fixture in the community and really for all of Las Vegas. And I wouldn't be doing his story justice if I didn't show you one of his commercials from the Buffalo Wrestling Federation.
"I'm Buffalo Jim, and I'm here with my brother, the mighty Yokozuna. Brother, why are you here?
The reason why I'm here in Las Vegas is to come out here and fulfill everybody's dream, and that is to become a professional wrestler. Anybody out there that's got the heart and the desire to become a two-time champion like myself, ask Mr. Bruno, my sports agent. That's the reason why we're here. So if you got this gut, come out here to the BWF."
Such a chaotic. It's awesome.
It's amazing. So the whole wrestling thing was interesting because he just happened to meet a professional wrestler when he moved to Vegas and they became good friends. And of course he was looking for, you know, a way to, he's already this, you know, larger than life character. And of course a professional wrestler, because a lot of the wrestlers are also kind of same type of way, like, oh, this guy is perfect. And Buffalo Jim, great business guy, you know? So he meets this professional wrestler and they're like, dude, you know, you want to open a gym together? Want to open this school? And so it kind of worked out perfectly for him. He was like, oh yeah. And he's like, well, as long as I can have my name on the gym, on the, you know, this, the school that he had, he was down. He was down to run the operations behind and all that. So it just really naturally worked. And I think he just really clicked with all the wrestlers in Vegas and they loved him and it just all kind of worked out.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
But Jim's kind-hearted nature didn't stop with those he taught at the wrestling school or even the regulars he'd let pay a few dollars for repairs if they had fallen on hard times, which I think says a lot about him. Jim was absolutely a devoted father to his four daughters who he loved more than anything. According to his daughter Jessica, Jim always wanted his daughters to have an excellent education because he didn't have one himself. Even after working 12-hour days at the repair shop, Jim would come home and ask his daughters how school was and help them with their homework, which says everything about him as a dad. But Jennifer even recounted when Jim pushed her to run for student council to help her get out of her shell. This is a great story. She said that he made her campaign posters, which featured him, Jessica, and a variety of famous wrestlers endorsing her for student council, which, how epic, you know? And I can imagine that all, you know, especially all the boys at the school were like, yeah, is that Hulk Hogan? I'll vote for you. Which Jessica says, you know, back in the day, she was embarrassed by it, you know, which we're all embarrassed by our parents at that age, right? If my dad was like, yeah, I want to be on your student council poster, man, I'd be like, please no.
No.
Please no. That's so embarrassing. Or if my dad did anything at school, seriously. If he showed up at my school, I'm like, oh, God.
Oh, leave.
One time my parents were like going to go meet with my teacher. And I remember being like, okay, when you come in and pass me, don't acknowledge me. Like, I don't know you. You don't know me.
Ain't that the truth, though? We're all so embarrassed. Yeah. Oh. As a parent now, I'm like dreading those days because it's going to be sad. And now I understand why my parents were sad when I was like disowning them. You know, I don't know him. Who's that? But, you know, Buffalo Jim was like, this is how you're going to get elected for student council. And it worked. Every time she ran for student council, winner. I mean, you can see why. She also said that Jim was, quote, able to identify traits that we lacked in and helped us overcome our struggles, which I think is what your job is as a parent. And Buffalo Jim exceeded at that. It was in the early 90s that Buffalo Jim met Steve Miller, who's a big part of this case. He was a popular city councilman who fought against the mob-run casinos in the late 80s, and Steve had become a journalist since leaving politics, and he had been assigned to cover Jim's wrestling school and was immediately taken by him, saying, quote, Jim was bigger than life, a big show-off, he was a wrestler, and the most selfless guy I knew. Steve and Buffalo Jim stayed close after Steve's initial story about Jim, but there was one problem. Jim had been a heavy cocaine user since the 1980s and was well known in the party scene across Vegas. And Steve told Jim that if we're going to be friends, man, I need you to stop using. Like, I just can't be around somebody like that. And Steve, obviously, he's got this long career. He also worked for the FAA, I believed. He had a, you know, pilot's license and stuff. He just was like, I don't want to jeopardize my life and my future hanging out with somebody who's using drugs. And so he personally takes credit for really helping Jim, you know, get off of cocaine and kind of move on with life, which I'm sure Jim was very appreciative of. So yeah, Jim was like, all right, man, if we're going to be friends, then I'll stop using. Not only did he want to kick the habit for Steve, but Jim had also developed a heart problem and he didn't want to pass away prematurely, you know, and leave his family alone. So definitely a lot of motivation there to get clean. Jim was really proud of his sobriety, you know, once he was able to get clean, and he stayed that way for over a decade. And so as time went on, things really seemed to be exploding for Jim. He was extremely successful. Celebrities were coming from Los Angeles to have their cars fixed by him, and people all over town just loved him. I mean, I can imagine he went everywhere and people were like, yeah, Buffalo Jim. You know, he's just really a Vegas staple at this point. And, you know, he's this community oriented guy and, you know, life is good. That is until trouble started brewing. So in the 90s, the complex Jim's Auto Repair Shop and Wrestling School were based out of was purchased by a man named Rick Rizzolo, who ended up being his next door neighbor, owner, and operator of the infamous strip club, the Crazy Horse 2. Before we move further into Buffalo Jim's case and what happened to him, I think it's really important that you have an understanding of Las Vegas and its long history that's very much intertwined with the American Mafia, because this plays such a big role in this case. So the Mafia in the United States gained immense wealth during Prohibition as they trafficked alcohol from Canada and other countries to the United States to sell at premium prices. You know, they're taking advantage of the situation. And this is how the Mafia controlled politics, business, and even police departments in some of the largest cities across the country. And because of this, crime families were established, influence was split, and violence followed. However, after Prohibition was repealed in 1933, the Mafia, you know, they had to find a new business and other markets to exploit to keep up their immense wealth. And most families maintain a legitimate business to launder cash that they receive from street-level crimes like extortion, loan sharking, and illegal gambling. But it's also important to note that at this time, fully initiated Mafia members were not allowed to sell or distribute drugs. However, the mob was unable to find another business as lucrative as the sale of illegal alcohol, which is why in the 1930s and 40s, they turned their eyes to Las Vegas. Because in Vegas, mobsters invested money in large casinos, fancy restaurants, and local politicians to draw tourists to this seemingly desolate town in the middle of the desert. You know, back in the 30s and 40s, it was kind of, Vegas was still coming up. It wasn't what it is today. The crime families in Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York used the Vegas casinos to not only launder money from their street-level crimes back home, but also engage in a process known as skimming. Now, skimming, as explained in the movie Casino, is a process in which a large casino is owned by someone affiliated with the Mafia, but not a full-fledged member themselves, and enforced by a made man. Usually this enforcer was a mob hitman in one of the main cities, and then they sent them to Las Vegas for their loyalty. They're like, we can trust this guy to go take care of business. And an example of this type of person is Anthony Spilotro, who likely killed over 25 people throughout his lifetime. So because the casinos were cash businesses, the frontman or the enforcer would go into the counting room at the end of every night and quote unquote skim cash from that day's earnings, which yielded millions of untaxed cash. So they're like skimming some of that money off the top, right? Throughout the 50s and 60s, this process allowed the mob to run Las Vegas. And those who stood in the way of the front men running the casinos, you can probably guess what happened to them. I mean, they were met by serious violence by the enforcer. But once the RICO Act was passed in 1970, raids at casinos across the city led to high-ranking mafia members being arrested. And eventually, they were tried for tax evasion and running criminal enterprises out of these casinos. Most of these mobsters, including Tony Spilotro, were represented by a man named Oscar Goodman, who would eventually become the mayor of Las Vegas and ran unopposed for several elections. And while many of these mobsters were either given jail time or forced to never enter Las Vegas again, guys like Tony Spilotro were acquitted after being represented by Oscar. However, Tony was murdered in 1986 by his own crime family once he returned to Illinois. In the 1980s, the laws were changed to allow corporations to obtain gaming licenses, and the casinos that were vacated once the mobsters were arrested were either purchased by corporations or just torn down to make way for new casinos to be built. And any person who is affiliated with the Mafia were put in a black book, banning them from any casino in Vegas. Men like Oscar Goodman said these efforts erased the mob for Las Vegas, but this couldn't be further from the truth. Instead, the mob did just as they had after the repeal of Prohibition, and they're like, all right, we're going to go back to street-level crime, paying off politicians, and guess what? We have this new business that we really like, strip clubs. In 1978, a topless bar called Billy Joe's was purchased by a mobster named Tony Albanese, who renamed it to Crazy Horse 2 after his other successful strip club. In 1981, Tony went missing after he told his wife he was headed to a business meeting. 3 months later, his head was found in the desert outside of Needles, California. And his murder, like so many murders associated with the mob, is still unsolved. And it's very likely he got caught up in a gang war between mobsters in Chicago and LA over control of the adult industry in Las Vegas. Now, businessman Bart Rizlo purchased the Crazy Horse 2 in 1984, and his son Rick oversaw operations until he became a majority stakeholder in 1986. Now, as we go forward here, we have to be careful and we have to use allegedly a lot because Rick is still alive and apparently very litigious. So obviously, don't want to get in trouble here. Allegedly, the Rizzolo family had deep ties to the Chicago mob and Rick was the frontman for the Crazy Horse with multiple confirmed Chicago mobsters as his alleged enforcers. For one, they hired Fred Pachente, an ex-Chicago cop and former employee at Chicago's version of the Crazy Horse, which paid Rick $20,000 monthly in consulting. Not only was Fred in the Black Book, but he had been arrested in Las Vegas for drug trafficking. And when asked if he was aware of Fred's arrest, Rick said, quote, "I was standing next to him." I'm going to throw a lot of names at you, so just hang in there with me. I promise it's all going to make sense in the end. But he also employed Rocco Lombardo as the floor man at the Crazy Horse, whose brother, Joey the Clown, was his nickname. Lombardo was one of the top advisors in the Chicago Mafia. And when asked if Rocco was Joey the Clown's brother, Rick said, quote, "I wouldn't know. His brother's name is Joey. I don't know if he's a clown or not." And then there was Vincent Ferracci, who was another alleged member of the Chicago mob, who was in the Black Book and the shift manager at the Crazy Horse. So you can see the types of people that work at the Crazy Horse, which this is important going forward. But Rick's alleged top enforcer was Joseph Cusimano, who was placed in the Black Book in 1990 for racketeering convictions and mob connections. He was allegedly a top lieutenant to Tony Spilotro and also was represented by Oscar Goodman in court. So you can see how everything's kind of interconnected here and all of the different connections also within the local government there. Because Rick was also very close friends with multiple people in City Hall, which is very convenient, right? It makes kind of taking over the adult industry a lot easier if you own the people in the local government. Councilman Michael McDonald, who once called Rick a, quote, "pillar of the community," somehow, maybe out of fear, lived rent-free in a villa owned by an associate of Rick's after he allowed Rizzolo to expand the Crazy Horse without acquiring the necessary permits. I couldn't help but think about Ozark, if you've seen that show. And there's tons of other shows that have similar kind of plot lines like this, where, you know, it's all corrupt, you know, in the local governments and things are just, you know, Ozark's a perfect example. You haven't seen it. Go watch it. You'll see what I mean. But Rick also donated over $100,000 to reelection efforts to his friends in City Hall. And after outcries from the community, one district attorney had to give the money back when Rick gave him $40,000 in campaign contributions. Convenient, right? In 1999, Rick's friend and mob lawyer, Oscar Goodman, became the mayor of Las Vegas. He was like, of course, we got to get Oscar in there. He's a mob friendly. He's making sure we stay out of trouble. Let's make him mayor of the city. And it worked. So allegedly, Rick used his connections in City Hall, including the mayor's office, to cover up his crimes. Aside from the legitimate business, you know, that they made at the club, their largest source of income was the practice of untaxed skimming, which was done in basically the same way as mob members had done in the past. But this was not the mafia of the 1960s. Dancers also sold large amounts of methamphetamines and crack cocaine out of the club. And the most lucrative business, aside from skimming, you betcha, extortion. There are multiple confirmed accounts of customers starting a tab with their credit card, getting offered a private dance, you know, taking them up on that offer, and then getting informed that they would have to pay for an additional hour after only a few minutes, which would end up costing $400 per hour. So, you know, the bill racked up real quick there. And guess what? If they refused, well, that's what the enforcers were there for. After refusing to pay the bill, Vincent Ferracci pushed one customer into the back alley. The customer was with a coworker who knew that they were going to be beaten. And so he just paid up the $400. He was like, I don't want any smoke. All right. I don't want to be beaten. So here's your $400. However, the customer later learned that the club had charged him an additional $1,300 while he was being intimidated by Vincent in the alley. So this is what they would do. You know, you go in thinking you're just going to enjoy the services of the Crazy Horse too. To find out immediately you're going to be extorted. You know, the dancers are all in on the operation and you're going to be walking out far less rich than when you walked in, no matter who you were.
Well, and I think the other thing about it is that a lot of these guys who are going to the Crazy Horse are business guys on like in Vegas for a conference, really. And then they're like, oh my God, I hear there's this club, this mob club called the Crazy Horse too. And a lot of these guys, like they're from places like Colorado or somewhere in the Midwest, like not a lot of mob stuff going on. So then they see these guys in suits talking like, you know, Italians. And they're like, oh fuck, we're going to get killed. And they, I mean, by all accounts, the workers at the Crazy Horse kind of relied on that. They were like, oh yeah, they think we're mob. We might be mob, but we can make them do whatever we want because they're scared of us.
Right. I guess for them, smart business plan.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Intimidation definitely works. This is nuts though. This just gives you really good perspective at how crazy this strip club was. So between the 90s and early 2000, cops were called to the Crazy Horse 2 over 700 times.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's.
Lowe's knows how to help make your home holiday ready for less. Get Select Style Selections vinyl flooring for just $1.99 per square foot and have it installed before the festivities begin. Our team can help you every step of the way. See a Lowe's Red Vest associate or visit lowes.com/holiday install to get started. Lowe's, we help, you save. Basic install only. Date restrictions apply. Subject to availability. Install by independent contractor. See associate for details. Contiguous U.S. only.
That's a lot of 911 calls. And often they're responding to calls of violence carried out by staff members. However, the cops who responded were members of a precinct that was 8 miles away from the club. And it was very strange that there was closer precincts to the club, but those officers never responded. And usually when they responded for service, these calls often led to nothing happening, nobody being charged or arrested. And many of the officers were later seen getting special treatment at the club while off duty. So they basically like either paid off the officers or like, hey, you can come get free services here if you agree to cover up all the shit we got going on here. And that worked for a long time. But some of the incidents were truly brutal that happened at the club. So in 1995, a man named Scott Faw was beaten to death near the train tracks behind the Crazy Horse. And Rick Rizzolo denies that anyone involved the club carried it out, but that's very hard to believe. Two of the bouncers from the Crazy Horse were admitted to a hospital that same night with broken hands, and the dots were never connected. Police never connected the dots, and so nobody was ever found guilty in Scott's death. And it wasn't just the bouncers who were involved in violence. In 1989, Rick Rizzolo pleaded guilty to the 1985 baseball bat beating of customer Rick Sandlin, who suffered permanent brain damage and died 3 days later. And guess what? Rick served no jail time, claiming he acted in self-defense. That's nuts to me that he got away with that.
Like self-defense with a baseball bat, yeah. And the other guy's completely unarmed?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
This is where the connections within City Hall really, really helped Rick out here, you know. In 2002, Rick Rizzolo purchased the complex that held the Crazy Horse 2, which included, as we mentioned earlier, Buffalo Jim's repair shop and his wrestling federation in school. So Rick went to Jim's office one day to discuss plans for him to move out of the space so Rick could expand the Crazy Horse, because he's probably like, if I make this a giant fucking club, I can hold far more people. And who knows what else his plans were if he got the rest of the building. But he knew that more space probably meant more money. But the problem was is that Jim had signed a 20-year lease, which is crazy. That's like, I've never heard of a 20-year lease before, but I guess they exist. But he was 11 years into that and only had 9 years left. He wasn't opposed to selling the business to Rick, as his business was valued in the millions of dollars. And obviously, he could just use that money to go buy or lease a larger space. But the problem was is that Rick wasn't interested in just buying out his business. He claimed that Jim was actually there on a year-to-year lease. And now that Rick was owner, he felt like he had the grounds to just evict him, like get him out of there. This was factually untrue. And Jim was like, fuck you, dude. Like, I signed a 20-year lease. I know how many years I have left on this. And he was like, you can try to intimidate me, but I was here first, dude. I'm gonna stay here as long as I want to. And apparently that meeting that they had, Rick ended it by putting a cigarette out on Jim's office rug. Just such a mob move, I feel like, to do.
Yeah. Also smoking inside.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
That part's
right.
Who wasn't doing that though?
I know. And in Vegas.
Yeah. I mean, it's Vegas. Well, it's,
and people are still doing it. Yeah.
But from then on, Buffalo Jim would have to go to war against Rick Rizzolo and his sketchy strip club as well. So you can see, you know, as soon as Rick Rizzolo entered Buffalo Jim's life, things immediately got difficult. Because obviously now you've got this guy who I think Buffalo Jim knew had mob ties. It was very easy to figure that out. I feel like it's not like they're like super discreet about what's going on. I mean, all the violence going on over there, the people that are working there, I think it was very easy for Jim to put two and two together. But at first, Rick tried to intimidate Buffalo Jim into getting him to vacate his business. Rick uses connections in City Hall to establish a fire lane in the parking spots directly outside Buffalo Jim's auto repair shop, which just limited the spaces as customers had to park their cars while they waited for service, which is a fucked up thing to do and really annoying, I'm sure, for Jim. And at night, Jim realized that the crazy horse used the parking spaces that were supposedly this fire lane for valet parking at the club. I was like, what the hell, dude? He realized Rick was using this as an obvious intimidation method. And Jim and Steve Miller reported this to the city, and the city went and removed that fire lane. Then allegedly, Rick began to resort to more traditional, less covert means of intimidation, including Buffalo Jim would come in to work in the morning to find that his customers' cars had been vandalized, windshield smashed, tires slashed, and the paint on numerous vehicles had been keyed, which that's one way to take an auto repair business down, is go and absolutely destroy all of their customers' cars. Like, how do you even like deal with that type of situation? Like, obviously Buffalo Jim's probably got insurance, but like that's detrimental. I mean, and that's going to kill future customers or returning customers. They're worried about dropping their nice vehicles off. Again, remember, there are celebrities dropping off very nice vehicles at Buffalo Jim's repair shop. That's probably going to deter them going forward because they're worried their car's going to get fucked up because they have this crazy man next door who's doing everything he possibly can, illegal shit, to get him out of there. And unfortunately, police ain't doing much. So he's kind of stuck. He's like, what do I do here? What can I do other than, like, you know, fight fire with fire? But that's not the Buffalo Jim way. Not only that, Buffalo Jim's office got broken into, and this is just messed up, but they're destroying his AC system. I mean, this is Vegas. You got to have AC pretty much year round. Like, obviously in the winter, the temperatures drop a bit, but AC is essential. And they just kept breaking in and fucking up his AC system that he had to have it fixed multiple times. And after the third time, the repairman's like, dude, why are you just wasting money on this? They're just going to come destroy it again. So this is what he's dealing with. Not only that, workers discovered that Jim's phone had been tapped during one of the repairs because they discovered a wire crudely running over the roof of Jim's repair shop directly into the Crazy Horse 2's office. I mean, how much more obvious can you get here? They're pulling out all the stops because they're like fucking with him. They're calling his phone over and over and over again during the day so that customers can't call in. They're pulling out all the stops. They're also tapping his phone to see who Buffalo Jim's talking to see if he's, you know, maybe Buffalo Jim's trying to get us taken down too. So who's he talking to? Jim's intimidators also proved that they had intimate knowledge of his family life. And this is where I think this is the scariest thing to me about having mobsters next door, is that when these initial intimidation tactics aren't working, are they going to escalate it and go after your family? Full well knowing that you start fucking with someone's family and that's going to change things and potentially allow them to get their way. Not only that, he received letters reportedly from a Las Vegas Metro cop that warned him that they had tapped his phones, intercepted his cell phone calls, and they knew where Jim lived, and that they were going to threaten his family. So around this time, Jim's wife, rightfully so, was scared for her life and her family's safety, so she separated from Jim and then took the children to Seattle. Eventually, one of Jim's oldest daughters, Elise, moved back to Vegas, and their youngest daughter, Jerrica, ended up moving back in with Jim, but the other two stayed in Seattle. And Jerrica, really cool person. She was featured in the Netflix Unsolved series that covered Buffalo Jim's story. Just seems like a really, really awesome person, and clearly loved her dad and misses her dad. But she became a fixture in Buffalo Jim's show, Jim Fights on Friday Nights. And she really became a Las Vegas character in her own right. And her nickname was Little Buff, which is very cool. And friends of Jim and wrestlers would call her that. But the threats from the crazy horse didn't stop. In fact, it got so bad that Bart Rizzolo, if you remember, Rick's father, allegedly tried to run Jim over while he was in the parking lot with the customers. So they're just escalating shit. They're like, this ain't working. Let's just fucking run him over. Or maybe they weren't going to actually run him over, and they were like just using it as an intimidation tactic, trying to make him think that we're going to kill you. But yeah, things are escalating. They had to jump out of the way in order to avoid being hit by the vehicle. Jim had sent multiple complaints and affidavits and even filed a lawsuit against Rick Rizzolo for the alleged damages, but law enforcement wasn't doing shit. As far as City Hall is concerned, Rick Rizzolo, he's a pillar of the community somehow, some way. Not paying his taxes, beating up people. Yeah, I don't really get that, but that's the corrupt City Hall for you. However, Jim and Steve soon gained assistance from another entity that was very interested in the alleged mob ties to the Crazy Horse too. None other than the FBI. The FBI had actually been investigating the Crazy Horse 2 since 1995, but it was a 2001 beating that really made the FBI ramp up their efforts in bringing down the club. This is crazy. But on October 2nd, 2001, a tourist named Kirk Henry disputed with management at the Crazy Horse over fraudulent charges on his credit card. According to an exotic dancer with connections to the club, she said a 350-pound bouncer did this. Charged this tourist, Mr. Henry, from behind, put him in a sleeper hold, then drug him outside and slung him into the parking lot, which caused him to break his neck. That is brutal. Like, that's not just like throwing you out the door. Like, that must have been like body slammed him onto the concrete outside, or maybe he just threw him up in the air. I mean, if he's that big and strong, he might just toss him up in the air and he landed directly on his neck. But then after that, the bouncer took Kirk's wallet, ran his credit card multiple times, took money out of his account, and then returned his wallet with only a folded $1 bill inside. Remember that. Kirk Henry was paralyzed from the neck down for the rest of his life just for being a customer to this club. Can you imagine being Kirk's family, knowing that your loved one went to Vegas, went to the strip club, which you assume would be
regulated,
be safe. You know, you're not going to have permanent injuries or die after visiting this place. And poor Kirk, he was paralyzed from the neck down for the rest of his life. That is just horrible. And while the Crazy Horse 2 said that Kirk was extremely drunk and he sustained his serious injuries, life-altering injuries, from just falling in the parking lot, that doesn't happen. There's no way. Because of this incident, it was enough for the FBI to open a RICO investigation into the club. Which I'm like, really? It took that happening? How about you guys should have jumped on this a while ago and saved poor Kirk from ever having this happen to him in the first place, but that's just me. But both Buffalo Jim and Steve Miller became FBI informants for the investigation. So now the tides are changing here. Steve Miller recounted how the FBI actually made his articles on the Crazy Horse go to the top of Google search results, which led to more people reaching out to him saying that they had either been coerced by staff at the Crazy Horse 2 or beaten by them. A former dancer at the Crazy Horse 2 spoke to Steve Miller for one of his articles saying, quote, They take joy and delight in being able to hurt people just because they're bored, just because they can, and just because they know they'll never be held responsible for it. So that's just the attitude. That's the mission statement at Crazy Horse 2. We just fuck people up because we're bored and because we know nobody's going to hold us accountable for it. On February 20th, 2003, at 5 a.m., 100 FBI agents raided the Crazy Horse 2. And this raid was actually a part of a larger investigation called Operation G-Sting. First time I went through this, I said G-String. But
well, and again, you're not alone. There is like...
kind of, I'm sure that's what they meant by G-Sting.
Exactly.
Like, that's what they're playing off of. Investigating strip clubs.
Right.
Yeah. So this whole operation was an attempt to clear the city of mob ties within the adult entertainment industry. But to no surprise, no arrests were made that day because that wasn't the FBI's goal. They found $800,000 in untaxed cash in Rick Rizzolo's office, but did not take him in. Instead, they used the raid to tap Rick's phone and bug all the rooms in the Crazy Horse 2. So it was like, that was the whole point of the raid, to literally go in and tap, which I'm like, wouldn't they know that? Like, if they didn't arrest anybody, wouldn't they have been smart enough to be like, I think they tapped all of our phones and bugged our rooms.
Right.
Because they're investigating us, clearly.
Right. Like, this is what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I do think there was, in one of the interviews with Steve Miller, he was talking about how much more sophisticated the FBI tapping and bugging was when compared to the alleged...
Not just splicing a cord.
Right.
Or a wire.
Yeah. I think Steve said there was like a tiny, tiny little thing that they would quite literally put inside of a phone. So you actually would, like, the recording device was this big, and there would be absolutely no, like, there's no clicking noise like you see in the movies. Like, it's just there.
They could have speculated that maybe they were being monitored, but they would physically not be able to see any change to anything. Because, like, they weren't ready to take him down yet. You know, they're trying to build a case against Rick Rizzolo. They're trying, you know, that's what the FBI does, right? They don't just go after, they usually don't go after just one person. They go after organized crime. They want to take down criminal enterprises and completely rid Vegas of all mob ties. But what's interesting is that Rick had some famous associates, actors that had crossed paths with him, including Robert De Niro, Joe Pesci, and George Clooney, who actually met Rick while filming Ocean's 11. And in that movie, they used the Crazy Horse as a location in the film. And they ended up all being questioned as a part of this FBI investigation, which is kind of interesting to me. But the first arrest came in November 2004 when Bobby DePiche, the bouncer who allegedly broke Kirk Henry's neck, was arrested for racketeering charges, assault for the 2001 beating of Kirk, aiding and abetting in prostitution and distribution of narcotics. In March 2005, Rick and his lawyers expected that an indictment would soon be underway. So he attempted to sell off the club in anticipation. He's like, well, all right, if they're coming for me, I'm just going to clean my hands of this and get out of here. And as they imagined, a potential plea deal would involve settling the civil suit with Kirk Henry. So on June 1st, 2006, Rick Rizzolo and 16 other employees at the Crazy Horse 2 pleaded guilty to federal racketeering charges. However, Rick was the only one forced to serve 1 year and 1 day in jail, which I'm like, they couldn't get him more time. Like, I don't understand.
Well, I think we know why he only got, because yes, the FBI is the one who built this case.
Right.
But the person who litigated it, the DA, just so happened to be the DA that Mr. Rizzolo gave $40,000 to, and he had to return.
And don't they believe they even had like a judge on there?
He was definitely connected to the judge as well. Yes.
So despite all the FBI's work here, Rick only is handed down a sentence of 1 year, 1 day. He was also forced to sell the Crazy Horse 2 within 12 months, which you think would be like, all right, that's kind of a win, but not really. Unfortunately, as we'll see, but he also had to pay $17 million in fines and an additional $10 million to Kirk Henry, which again, just because you're ordered to pay that doesn't mean that person's going to see any of that money. For Buffalo Jim and Steve Miller, this seemed to be a pretty light sentence for a RICO charge. While they were happy that Rick and the club were going down, it was strange that Rick was the only one who served jail time, even though the investigation alleged that everyone involved in the club was in deep with the racketeering scheme. So there, it wasn't like there was anybody truly innocent working inside the club. Everybody was clued into the operation. And they pointed to the fact that the state's prosecuting attorney was the same DA Rick donated $40,000 to his campaign, which the money had to be returned following public outrage, as it should be. And on top of that, Jim's civil suits against Rick for the intimidation and destruction of his business had to wait until Rick was released. And for the next year while Rick was in jail, he attempted to sell the club to a slew of owners who were alleged straw men to hold up the actual purchase of the club so Rick didn't have to pay Kirk Henry or his fines. Because of course. The club ended up closing in August 2007 after the U.S. Marshals seized it following several failed purchase attempts. But Rick Rizzolo was given a release date of April 4th, 2008. Now, this is important because now we're arriving to Buffalo Jim's last day. And what happened? As Rick's release from prison became imminent, Jim suspected something might happen to him. He told his family that if they tried to kill him, they'd, quote, get to him through a woman, and they'd do it with drugs. In the days leading up to Buffalo Jim's death, he received multiple letters from a, quote, anonymous Metro police officer, including one he received on April 5th, 2008, stating that multiple meetings had been held throughout town with Bart and Rick Rizzolo that was specifically to discuss Jim's fate. But for Jim, the beginning of April 5th, 2008 was, in Steve Miller's opinion, quote, the best day of his life. And reason for it being the best day of his life was because filming had just wrapped on a network TV show about Buffalo Jim's life. He had even completed a run for mayor as an arc for the documentary series. And while his campaign was largely just seen as a publicity stunt, it's awesome. He like built this whole Buffalo out of like paper mache that like breathed fire or smoke rather. That was really cool. And he'd be out there like in the streets handing out flyers for his campaign. But he's an entertainer at heart. And again, he did use his campaign to speak out against the mob. So obviously this pissed him off even more. He also signed a lease to expand his repair shop. While it was in a different building than the original shop, it was spacious, it was clean, and according to Steve Miller, it was just absolutely beautiful. So a lot of things to be excited about. Plus, he had just gotten a custom chrome motorcycle that he had ordered the previous year from West Coast Customs that had been unexpectedly delivered that day. So Jim was super stoked to get this dope ass motorcycle from West Coast Customs, and he was riding it all around town. You know, life is good right now. But that evening, Jim received a phone call from a woman known as, quote, Lisa, whom Jim had been friends with since the 80s. I think her last name's out there somewhere, but most people who report on this case do not say her name. Mm-hmm. So we'll just call her Lisa. Lisa was a dancer at the Crazy Horse 2, and she had called Jim to see if he wanted to purchase a motorcycle owned by her cousin. Jim told his daughter Jerrica that he was on his way out and would be back home by midnight. She doubted him, and Jim bet her $100 that he would return within a few hours. Jim then got into his classic white Rolls Royce and left his house. Of course he had a Rolls Royce. So cool. At around 8:22 p.m., Jim is seen checking into a Motel 6 off of Boulder Highway in an older residential section of Las Vegas. We do have security camera footage of Jim entering the Motel 6. And we'll play it for you in a sec, but you can see Jim moving across the window. I believe this is a clip of the, because the cameras on the outside of the Motel 6 weren't working, after what happens next happens and police go and get security footage, this is the only footage that they're able to get. So let's watch it actually here. So if you're listening, it's a camera shot of the lobby. Here's Buffalo Jim rolling in. He's kind of got a button-down shirt, some sweatpants on, and he's checking in. You can see some other people behind him, and then he walks out the door. And then the next shot is kind of hard to see. It's not the most clear, but you can see what looks to be Buffalo Jim walking on the outside. And then there is a silhouette following him. So clearly he went to the Motel 6 to meet somebody there. So as the night went on and it got late, Jerrica became worried. It was completely unlike Jim not to return home to his daughter, especially when he promised her he'd be home, you know, after just a few hours. But he never came home. So she called her older sister, Elise, who then came and stayed at the house with her that night. Then the next morning, April 6, housekeeping knocked on the door of the room that Jim had checked into. And when there was no response from the other side, the housekeeper opened the door to find a man she assumed to be sleeping, lying on his back in bed. Several hours later, housekeeping returned and found the man in the same position. At this point, they're like, let's just maybe double check. They could tell this is kind of weird. So they went in and checked his pulse and realized that he was deceased. They then removed the blanket that was covering him and discovered that he was naked from the waist down. The hotel then contacted Las Vegas Metro Police, who then called Jerrica and Elise to the scene to identify the man as their father, Buffalo Jim Barrier. And this was a very traumatic moment for his daughters because when they arrived, they saw their father in a body bag with his face only revealed for identification. The girls immediately noted that the motel room was not being treated like a crime scene and that the evidence that was within the room was being handled with bare hands. Because, of course, his daughters are like, he did not do this to himself. Something happened here. Their first thoughts was somebody murdered him because of all the things that Jim had been saying leading up to this day. They're like, he's been worried. You know, he's seemed more anxious off. You know, he's worried people are after him. He's getting these threatening letters. And so they knew right away. They're like, something is not right about this. Why the hell is the police not handling this as a crime scene? And I think this is the biggest failure by law enforcement in this case, is that they did not see this as a crime scene whatsoever. They just saw a guy that had died on the bed. And, you know, there's some other things that they found that would lead them to believe that he potentially overdosed in that hotel room. The other interesting thing is that when his daughters arrived, they couldn't find Jim's car, his Rolls Royce, in the Motel 6 parking lot. And that should be very easy to find because it's a Rolls Royce in a Motel 6 parking lot. So they filed a stolen vehicle report and then were like, maybe he left his car over at a casino that he frequented and maybe valet had it. So they headed over there to see if his car was there. And while searching the casino's lot, they received a call from Metro Police who told them that Jim's Rolls Royce was in the Motel 6 parking lot and they must have just missed it. Which, what?
Mm-hmm. There's no way.
This makes no sense whatsoever. But the cops are really doing their best to convince Jim's daughters that, oh yeah, we must have just missed it. You guys missed it. It's here. Silly us. Come on back. His car's right where he left it. As far as what happened to Jim, we know he's deceased. And the coroner, when they took a look at Jim's body, they determined that he died of an accidental overdose, citing his heart condition, which was cardiomyopathy and an overuse of cocaine. We'll talk about this more in a little bit, but there's some problems with this analysis here. But Buffalo Jim was buried on April 12, 2008, and hundreds of people from all walks of life gathered in the Palms Mortuary Chapel. The crowd was so large that the pastor even said, quote, this is unprecedented.
Yeah, so this is just a clip that local news did. Actually, George Knapp, the famous UFO reporter.
Oh, the I-Team investigator.
Yes.
He was on this, huh?
Yes, he actually is the one who's reporting on this story, which is very interesting.
That is very cool.
Yeah, cool. I love George Knapp. But he interviews Elise and Jessica right afterwards in this.
Wait, Jennifer.
Jennifer, my bad.
One of our town's most colorful characters died over the weekend. Businessman and pro wrestler Buffalo Jim Barrier died unexpectedly. His body was discovered in a motel room on the Boulder Highway. Officials say he died of natural causes, although those close to him suspect foul play. I-Team reporter George Knapp recalls the life of a Las Vegas original.
We have a camera. As likable and outgoing as Jim Barrier was, he sure found himself involved in a lot of skirmishes, such as when he found surveillance cameras aimed at his little auto repair shop on Industrial, or the numerous police reports he made about events he witnessed at the now-shuttered Crazy Horse 2 topless nightclub right next door to his business. Barrier, known far and wide by his nickname Buffalo, was a tireless promoter for his business, his causes, and most of all, himself. Like the time he built a gigantic, animated, smoke-belching, papier-mâché buffalo that he intended to enter in the El Dorado parade until the parade was canceled.
And you're disappointed that parade's canceled?
Yeah, I wanted this bad boy in the parade. I thought the people of Las Vegas would like it, brother.
Barrier was a professional wrestler and wrestling promoter who produced his own late-night wrestling show on cable TV. The walls of his shop were plastered with photos of famous wrestlers, boxers, and other celebrities who became his acquaintances. He also courted media personalities and wrote his own auto repair newspaper column. Over the weekend, the body of the 55-year-old Barrier was found in a motel room on the Boulder Highway. Barrier's longtime friend, former councilman Steve Miller, suspects foul play and says Barrier had received death threats in recent days. Buffalo's distraught family has similar suspicions.
We don't know at this time. We just believe it was a homicide.
We just found out yesterday. It's not real to us.
It's not real.
I mean,
I still think he's here. I think he's in his office right now. I don't think he's gone. I think he's still alive.
Officially, though, police do not suspect foul play at this point. The fire department's initial conclusion is that Barrier died of natural causes. Unless a coroner's autopsy finds something unusual, Metro says there will be no formal investigation. Either way, Barrier's death leaves a big, burly hole in the hearts of his loved ones.
He just loved people in general, you know, Buffalo Jim. Everyone, you know, knew him as the character. He liked to always put on a show.
I think that's a great clip because it provides a lot of a great context and insight into who Buffalo Jim was, for one. I love just his personality. And if you watch other clips of him, he always, whenever he's talking to somebody, he's always like, brother. Brother, he's his brother, like, constantly. It's amazing. I just love his whole vibe. It's seems like such a cool guy. Just, you know, everybody loved, and so everybody was obviously very upset when he passed. And clearly, you can see from the clip that his daughters were like, "There is no way that he just died from natural causes." You know, he was murdered. You know, they right off the bat, they're like, this was homicide, because of course they know far more than everybody else did. And I think from first glances, everybody thinks natural causes because of his heart condition, but let's dig into that a little bit more. So let's talk about the investigation, because there's a lot of inconsistencies with it when you really dig into it. But because this was, you know, according to the coroner, as you heard the fire department, people responded to the scene. They're like, this is natural causes. The Metro Police really did very little to no investigation into his death beyond the obvious. And even the obvious, I think, raises some questions. But they just closed the case. They're like, yep, there's nothing to this. This is what happened. But his family refused to accept their conclusion here. And I can see why. For one, Jim's motel room was never treated as a crime scene, and the evidence found within was compromised. Photos from the scene showed the contents of Jim's pockets on the bed in between his legs, indicating that investigators had removed everything from his pockets before taking any pictures. Which, I think, when I think about this, it's possible, you know, when they got there, you know, maybe they're looking for ID or something, so maybe they just took things out of his pockets, but again, they clearly walked in assuming he died of natural causes. Can you blame them entirely? Not necessarily, I think. I think I can definitely see a world where first responders would come in and just kind of assume what happened here. But again, you never, you know, as a police officer or law enforcement official, you should always consider all possibilities, especially since this is Buffalo Jim.
Right.
Right. If this was just some guy, you know, that wasn't in the news and had all this crazy shit happening at his repair shop, especially if you're a responding officer and you're like, you do identify who he is and you're like, wait a minute, hasn't Buffalo Jim been having all kinds of crazy shit going on at his repair shop? We've been called out to his building 700 times. is it possible there's somebody out, you know, out to get him? And again, you heard George Knapp. He was clearly investigating this. He was clearly looking into all the shenanigans going on over at the Crazy Horse 2. So it is kind of fishy to me that they just immediately jumped to the natural causes, most obvious conclusion to them. And maybe there's a reason for that. But let's talk about some more things here. Jim's beard and chest, and I believe under his nose, were covered in a white powder. However, before you make an assumption here, there was no container for the substance, no baggie, no nothing found anywhere in the room. And this is absolutely insane to me. But this substance, which we would all assume would probably be cocaine, was never tested, which is nuts to me. Why wouldn't you want to just confirm that this substance is in fact cocaine?
Right.
Especially, I could understand maybe if they went and they like found an open baggie and there was residue and like, you know, there was clearly some more there, like all over the place. But no, this powder that's found on him, they just assume it's cocaine, but they don't test it to confirm it, which is just a big swing and a miss. But inside the only container in the motel room was a pill bottle labeled for Jim's heart medication. Now, this is very odd as well. The pills inside that bottle were not Jim's heart medication, which I think is Norvast, I'm pretty sure.
I believe he took diazepam.
Or diazepam. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yes. It was Valium inside of it. So that's weird. Maybe Jim had a pill bottle that he used, possibly from a past prescription or something, that he just stored Valium in. But again, from by all accounts of people who knew him as family, he was not a drug user. He did not take drugs other than his prescription medication. So that's a little fishy as well. When the coroner report came back after they did the autopsy, it did indicate that Buffalo Jim had trace amounts of cocaine in his system. And this is important and something we'll talk about here in a minute. But what's even stranger is that two burner phones were found at the scene. And one of them was reportedly in Jim's pocket, which was not recorded into evidence by any means. Jim's family stated that they had never seen the phone that was said to have been in his pocket. So this is just some unknown phone. They don't know whose phone it is. It's possible he did have some type of burner phone, but it's possible it's somebody else's phone entirely. But again, police never really question it or even consider evidence. They don't care about it. So Jim's Rolls Royce, which had magically disappeared from the Motel 6 parking lot prior, when it reappeared in the Motel 6 parking lot, it was very clear that there was signs of evidence tampering and evidence planting when the police took a look at it. A white powdery substance, I would assume similar to the one found on Buffalo Jim, was found smeared into the seats, and there was a set of handwritten directions which led to an empty parking lot inside. However, there was no fingerprints or signs of DNA. And aside from the powder and directions, it would appear that no one had ever entered the car before. Jim's car had been taken before, and he feared that members of the Crazy Horse 2 had stolen his spare key during one of their alleged break-ins at his auto repair shop. So that's something to keep in mind. Police also did not impound Jim's car to search for evidence at all. It was immediately released to the family, and it wasn't until Steve Miller pressured police that they properly searched the vehicle. They literally brought the car back to I believe his house or somebody else's house. They kept it in the garage and tried to preserve it because they're like, we need to have police look over this. And police did eventually come out and do a search through it. But it doesn't seem like a proper, real deep forensic search was ever done on his vehicle. It was just kind of like police looked over it.
Do you think that was just them being lazy and negligent? Or do you think it was because they don't want to fuck with the mob? And
I think either is a possibility, honestly. I mean, we just don't know how deep the ties were within the Metro Police Department. I think it's possible, or it's just like, we'll just appease, you know, this family's upset.
Right.
And we'll appease them. They keep calling. They want us to look at this vehicle, send somebody out, look it over real quick and tell them it's, you know, there's nothing. But again, if there's a substance there, you would think a police officer would test the substance to confirm what it is.
Yeah.
To at least find out if it's cocaine or whatever. I mean, it could be chalk for all we know. It could be powdered sugar. I mean, police are just assuming. They're just assuming, well, it's clearly cocaine, but No need to test it. The police also had told Jarek and Elise that they must have missed Jim's car while searching the parking lot, if you remember, but how the hell did they miss a Rolls Royce in the parking lot of a Motel 6? Like, that is beyond me. I mean, you would think that they would look around the entire motel.
I'm pretty sure it would stick out like a sore thumb
right
amongst the other vehicles in the Motel 6 parking lot.
Well, and it wasn't full up either. So there's,
yeah,
it wasn't like they had no vacancy and every spot was full. Like, it was pretty, like, I'm looking at the picture of it right now. It's just a standard Motel 6. There's like, it's not this giant parking complex.
There's nowhere to hide that.
Right.
So I think everyone's assumption is that somebody moved the vehicle and did it because they were likely planting evidence in it to further stage the scene where Buffalo Jim was found dead. I guess that's kind of the leading theory, because I don't know how else you explain this, because Buffalo Jim didn't move it. You know, who moved it? Was it the Metro Police? Were they the ones that planted evidence at the scene? Something weird happened here. But let's talk about Lisa, because I think if anybody knows what really happened, it's got to be Lisa. She at least was there, supposedly, in Buffalo Jim's last moments. This is the other frustrating thing, is that Lisa's questioning was not great. They only interviewed her once, and she stated that she had reached out to Jim to see if he was interested in purchasing her cousin's bike so he could make some extra cash. She said that afterward, they rode together in Jim's Rolls Royce to the Motel 6 to take drugs and engage in sexual fantasy games. According to her, Jim had grabbed his heart after ingesting cocaine and indicated that he was in pain. However, according to her, he continued to do cocaine until he started seizing, which that statement doesn't make sense either. If you're doing cocaine and you know you have a heart condition and you start having chest pain, what person's going to continue ingesting cocaine?
Right.
That person's probably going to be like, oh shit, I need to call an ambulance because I'm going into cardiac arrest. So that's a little weird to me. Could have happened, yes, but a little weird. Lisa then told the police that she left the hotel room once Jim started convulsing and that she made no effort to contact him once she left the motel. So as Jim's seemingly having a seizure and convulsing on the bed, Lisa gets up and just basically runs out, which is very sketchy, very weird. Why on earth would you not, you know, maybe there's some prostitution going on there, but like,
then call and make an anonymous report.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
and then leave and after then leave, you call.
Right. Yeah. Like, get to this room. Bye.
And they found her anyway.
Yeah. Right.
So you did. Yeah. Like, they're going to find you anyway. So why'd you just leave him as he's dying? Definitely, definitely suspicious. Her statement, though, is untrue, because when Jerrica and Elise got Jim's actual cell phone back from the scene, they actually listened to two voicemails left by Lisa asking if he was all right.
Why would you do that? If you're going to...
Why run out
yeah,
to hide right. from the this right. scene that's unfolding?
To then call. Leave two voicemails. Clearly, if you call twice and you don't get an answer, something's fucking wrong. So then you should probably be like, that's odd. No one's picking up. I should probably call the police. Like, this is such a setup.
Yeah, that's what it really seems like, is something either... Lisa's statements about what happened are completely untrue because she's covering up for what really happened. And for all we know, she just walked Buffalo Jim to the room and then didn't see anything that happened after that. And she was told to say this by somebody else who is involved in his death. Because I mean, I don't really know how else that her statements really make sense. Or she just is dumb and just felt bad and then called him after the fact, when she probably perfectly knew, if it happened the way she said, that he died.
Right, right.
Like, I don't know. It just doesn't, another very weird thing about this. Police also never questioned Lisa's unnamed cousin and did not ask who supplied the cocaine that they supposedly used together in the room, and obviously ask more about the cocaine usage in the Rolls Royce. All very weird. In addition, the police report states that Jim asked Lisa to meet up, even though Lisa said in her interview with them that she reached out to him. Okay, so we got conflicting reports.
Right. Well, and also, if like they made their report based off of Lisa's interview with them, so why is it just the opposite of what she said? Like, she literally said, I called Jim to ask if he wanted to hang out. And in the report, it says, Jim contacted Lisa. Like, it's just complete bullshit.
There's clearly a lot of covering up going on here. I mean, there's just no other way around it, or just complete incompetence on a whole other level. But when you know what you know about Buffalo Jim and who he's involved with, it seems pretty obvious. When looking back at Jim's belongings, it's important to note that Jim would carry thousands of dollars of cash in his pockets. He's just cash is king type of guy. He'd roll around with thousands of dollars of cash, and he never stored that cash in his wallet. He'd only keep his IDs and credit cards in there. If we remember, the cash at the scene was only a single $1 bill folded neatly inside of Jim's wallet. And if you recall, when Kirk Henry was paralyzed at the Crazy Horse 2, a single $1 bill was put in his wallet once staff had withdrawn money from his account. You know, to those that understand and have looked into the situation, they believe this is an alleged calling card for a mob hit. The most glaring misstep by the police in this investigation is that hotel records indicate that someone had entered Jim's room 7 minutes before he checked in. And not only that, this person had used a guest key card instead of a staff key card and may have been waiting for Jim to arrive. And as far as we can tell, the police never searched hotel records to determine who this unknown person was. Because we saw the security footage from the lobby. Where's the footage of this person getting the guest key card? Where is that? Why was that not looked at? Very sketchy. I don't understand. If that happened, why have you not identified this individual?
Have they ever talked to any of the employees that were working at the Motel 6 that night?
No.
Because it, like, from what we can tell, no, because they'd never considered it a criminal investigation.
It's like, but why not just go talk to them?
Right.
You know, you don't have to go get a statement, you know?
Something, anything.
They clearly came to the scene and immediately determined this guy died of natural causes or a drug overdose based on the visual cues, and they called it a night or called it a morning.
Yeah.
They were like, oh. That's what this is. And that happens a lot, unfortunately. And this is why we have cases like this, where suspicious deaths that seem to indicate foul play was involved don't get solved. So for obvious reasons, Jim's family suspects he was murdered and that Jim was a victim of a mob hit. Not only did Jim die the day after Rick Rizzolo is released from prison, but his death shares many similarities with the killing of gambling executive Ted Binion, whose death was initially ruled as a heroin overdose. However, his death was later reclassified as a homicide, and investigators suspected that his girlfriend and her lover suffocated him before they put drugs into his system. So here you have an example of basically the same circumstances. In my opinion, I think this could absolutely happen to Buffalo Jim. He's there to meet Lisa. Could have been somebody else there, and they suffocated him in some way. Maybe they smothered him or something. One of them held him down, and then they put cocaine everywhere. I think that's a possibility. I think, you know, people would point to, well, why isn't there more evidence on the body of some type of physical trauma or some type of additional harm being done? But I was like doing a little research on smothering. And there is a possibility that if someone is smothered to death, that there is no physical signs to the body that that was the way that they were killed. Usually, if there is, there's some bruising in the face from, you know, having something held down over someone's face, but it not always. There's not always something like that. And who knows? I mean, who knows what other ways, you know, these enforcers have. I mean, these are professionals. We're talking about hitmen, basically. There's lots of different ways that people can be killed without leaving any sort of physical signs. So who really knows? It's very possible this was a staged drug overdose scene. Jim's family even paid an independent pathologist to perform an autopsy, which was extremely smart. But what's so weird about this, and I don't know exactly why, but this pathologist never released the findings to the family, which I would love more clarification on that. But that's very strange. Why would you pay somebody to do an independent autopsy, but they're not going to give you the findings?
Maybe they were threatened.
That's what, because she also, this independent pathologist, she promised that she would not only film the autopsy, but take like very intense notes and then give all of it to the family. Like she was like, I'm going to film everything I do and you're going to see it. So we know exactly what happened to him. And then she never gave them anything.
That's wild. I wonder if they could have sued her or like that. That's just crazy. That happened, period. You know, Jim was buried and now the family is trying to get Jim's body exhumed so that they can test his hair samples for drug use. Cause I think that's a big question here is there's this white substance found on him. Coroner saying cocaine overdose, which, and the cocaine overdose caused the cardiac arrest. The two of those are what killed him. But the family's like, no, you know, he was clean for years and years and years. If we can pull this hair sample, maybe we'll be able to figure out whether that's true or not, you know, and clear his name, you know, because he's, you know, that's how a lot of people remember him passing, is he died of a drug overdose, which of course his family doesn't want that if that's not the truth. Now, this kind of throws a little bit of a wrench into all this, but Steve Miller, one of his longtime friends who we've been talking about, believes that Jim had actually been using cocaine earlier that day, or maybe just drugs. He said that Jim had called him in the afternoon and he sounded high. And according to Steve, between the new space and his new bike, again, this had been best day of Jim's life, that just out of like feeling good about life and out of celebration for the day, he potentially relapsed and used some cocaine. Despite that, though, Steve still believes there was foul play in Jim's death, regardless of whether he was using cocaine that day.
Well, and I think like looking back at the coroner's report, it does actually lend credence to that possibility, because I believe the proper term is there were 245 nanograms per milliliter in Jim's body of cocaine when they did the report. However, you need at least 300 nanograms per milliliter to even trip a drug test for cocaine. So this is like an incredibly small amount. And so this kind of leads to Steve's potential theory that if Jim had been using cocaine earlier in the day, by the time, you know, that he died, it would have been like largely out of his system. And he maybe didn't even do cocaine that night.
That checks out to me. I mean, I think, is it possible too, if we think about the theory that, you know, he was forcefully given cocaine, is it possible that cocaine was cut with something else that could have potentially stopped his heart and it didn't show up on the coroner's report, you know, because it wasn't something that was part of that panel or something. You know, I'm no expert on that, so I could be wrong, but I think it is a possibility, you know, if in fact that was the reason that he died, was because of the substance that he ingested that was found on his body. But again, that could have all just been planted there, as you just said, and the cocaine that showed up on the report was from earlier in the day, from him just celebrating, you know, and he used a little bit. I think it's interesting that Steve was very honest about that and said that, because I think that's very helpful information to finding out the truth. But following Jim's death, Steve began receiving threatening letters from the quote-unquote Rizzolo family, taking credit for Jim's death and saying that he was next. Steve's car was also vandalized after receiving the letters. What's interesting is that Steve does not believe someone in the Rizzolo family sent that letter because, quote, there's only one member of the family stupid enough to do something like that. He does believe it is suspicious, though. This is really interesting, and shout out to true crime YouTuber Eric Allen. He did a very good job covering this case. He actually went and interviewed Steve and Buffalo Jim's family members and went to the sites that this all happened. Eric presented the theory to Steve that the anonymous police officer who used to write Buffalo Jim and the author of Steve's threat letters were the same person. He pointed out similar misspellings and ink bleeding, indicating that both letters had been folded similarly, which is, yeah, he kind of dove into the letters a bit, and I found it really, and like, your was spelled Y-O-U-R when the correct way to spell it based on, help me out here, writer,
the grammatical.
Grammatical.
Yeah, I mean, just the usage.
The usage, yeah, yeah, thank you. Yeah. I'm like, conjugation? I'm like... would be Y-O-U apostrophe R-E. And so he was kind of pointing out some different things with that. The reason why this is kind of shakes things up is because Steve had never believed that they were written by the same person before. He said that by looking at the letter side by side when Eric presented it to him was very convincing. I mean, it's seems pretty clear that this was likely one person sending both of these letters.
Well, and as we've mentioned, the letters that Buffalo, that Jim would receive throughout his life, they were sent to him by, you know, a quote, anonymous police officer, but anonymous is spelled completely wrong. And it is written in, I believe, like multiple people point out, like it is written in police, in a police format where everything's capitalized, it's all bolded.
Yes.
But you'd think, I mean, you know, I don't know many police officers in my life, but they don't misspell words like anonymous. They typically know how to spell words like that.
Yeah. So what's like the theory behind it, and why is this important? Isn't there speculation that he was potentially Buffalo was writing these letters?
There is speculation that Buffalo himself was writing the letters just to basically get the cops to move on it by being like, look, one of your own guys is writing me saying that my family's threatened and they're going to kill me. But if we're to believe that the same author wrote the letters to Steve after Buffalo Jim's death, then that theory is out of the water. I personally believe that it was both letters were written by the same person, and they were likely, allegedly involved with the Rizzolo family. And the reason they took up the moniker of like a police officer was to make Jim feel more threatened. Like, not only are they threatening me, but they're in with the cops because this police officer knows about it and they're not doing anything to stop it.
I think that's a really good theory. It makes sense, right? Because they're continuing to escalate things, trying everything they can to intimidate him. So what better way to do it than be like, well, now there's nobody to run to, nobody to help you, because now the police also know what's going on. So yeah, I can definitely see that. But let's talk about the aftermath of Buffalo's death. So after he died, one of his oldest daughters, Jessica, ran the auto repair shop for a few years before they sold the business. And as you can imagine, the Buffalo Wrestling Federation stopped operating after Jim's death. However, Rick Rizzolo, he stayed in the news. After years of being unable to sell the Crazy Horse 2, Rick was ordered to pay Kirk Henry $1 million out of his $10 million settlement. Even though the club finally sold in 2013, Rick still dragged his feet on paying out Kirk's settlement. In 2014, Rick was indicted for tax evasion charges, and in 2017, he was sentenced to just 2 years in prison this time, in order to pay over $2.6 million. Sadly, Kirk Henry passed away in 2017, months before Rick went to prison, and he never received his full settlement, which is just sad. Vincent Ferracci, the manager of the Crazy Horse 2, was also sentenced to prison for 15 months following tax evasion charges in 2013. And Rick's own son was able to avoid jail time in 2007, for an extortion and stabbing case while he was in Florida. But the Crazy Horse 2 suffered from a lack of business when it reopened under new management in 2013, and multiple employees were arrested for drug trafficking and prostitution. Because you can imagine, Crazy Horse 2 is on all law enforcement's radar at that point. And for years, the club only opened once a month to retain its liquor license. And on June 5th, 2022, a fire tore through the club and damaged the roof. Subsequently, the city ended up condemning the complex, and in December of 2022, the Crazy Horse 2 and the side of Jim's auto repair shop and wrestling school were demolished. While Jim's family wants his case to be reopened and his body exhumed, it's sadly unlikely going to happen. The FBI has expressed interest and they claim to have, you know, a file, a case open, but the issue is jurisdiction. The Las Vegas Metro Police, it's their jurisdiction. This didn't happen on federal property or anything like that. So in order for the FBI to help out and help look into this further, it's really up to the Las Vegas Metro Police to reopen Buffalo Jim's case. And it doesn't seem like anybody over there is interested in doing that, unfortunately. It's unlikely we'll ever know the truth about Buffalo Jim's death or who's really accountable for it. I hope otherwise. I hope for his family's sake that Las Vegas Metro Police eventually decides to reopen it. I do worry that anything related to this case, can it be trusted? Is it even possible to do a full investigation into this? I mean, most of the people involved are probably gone or in prison at this point. I don't know how much they could do, or, you know, because there was such a shoddy investigation at the beginning, you know, the crime scene's gone, that substance is gone. I don't even know if they did exhume him, it, like, how much analysis they could do via DNA or hair sample at this point. I mean, I just really don't know. But I stand with them in figuring out what happened, because I think this is just an atrocity that it wasn't handled differently. And at least I love medical examiners and law enforcement officers who approach scenes like this and are like, we always assume it's murder, then work backwards. You know, always assume that something worse happened and then come back to maybe the most logical possibility. But that doesn't happen. But yeah, that is the case of Buffalo Jim. Definitely want to know your thoughts out there. You know, what do you think happened? Who do you think's responsible? Or if there's other theories around this. I mean, I think we all are pretty much in agreement that this was a setup. He was clearly lured there and he was murdered. And I think the substance was just planted there.
Yeah, I agree.
Agreed.
Especially Steve Miller explaining the cocaine really solidifies that for me. And especially when you compare it to the actual toxicology report with it being a trace amounts, essentially. Would even trigger a drug test? So how does that equal drug overdose? And I think the coroner's report just reflects, well, he took cocaine and that must have stopped his heart. You know, just that little bit of cocaine that he had earlier. And again, I know there's going to be people that are like, well, it is possible that he was having this sexual encounter with Lisa and because he hadn't had cocaine in 9 years, his heart wasn't in the best health. And maybe just doing that little bit of cocaine earlier in the day set in motion, you know, something in his body. And yeah, he just, you know, his heart stopped working and he just died. I'm not totally against that. I think that is a possibility here. Because again, we just don't know. There just wasn't enough done to really go fully in one direction or the other. Unfortunately,
I just think if that were the case, there'd be a lot of coincidences that happen.
Yeah, it'd be crazy coincidences. Yeah. The day after Rick Rizlo gets out of prison, come on. Crazy, crazy coincidences, which not to say coincidences happen all the time, but.
Well, and also it's like, if we're to believe all the substances found were cocaine, then it's like, his face was covered in cocaine, his chest was covered in cocaine, his car was covered in cocaine, and then there's only trace amounts, like, in his toxicology report. That would mean that, like, all of the cocaine he did, he just put on his body or spilled somewhere. Like, he didn't actually do it. So it just, and then you just compare it to all the other bullshit, like the fact that his heart medication was replaced with Valium. And then the fact that the car didn't even have his own fingerprints in it. Like, it didn't even have, it had nothing except for the cocaine and the directions in it. So it's just like, there's too many coincidences, like really too many.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. It's shocking that this wasn't taken more serious, like just considering all these other things. I just think they rushed to conclusions too quickly, and they likely were like, well, now we're going to look extremely bad going backwards. And then, you know, you add in mob ties and everything else, the corruption going on. I think you can see why this is the way that it is. It's extremely unfortunate. And, you know, I feel for his family. If can't even imagine just having to like deal with this, knowing like we know what happened to our dad, yet nobody seems to want to do anything about it because this corrupted Las Vegas Police Department wouldn't do anything because they just jump to conclusions. And then I think as soon as the coroner's report comes back, because that's then it's the game of like, well, now we got to get the coroner to change his cause of death. And, you know, they go back and forth and we got to get the DA. And it's just, it's, you know, becomes a systems issue at that point. Because if you go to the Las Vegas Metro Police today, it'd be like, well, the coroner said it was a drug overdose that which caused cardiomyopathy. So, you know, that's, you know, or natural causes or whatever. So unless he changes his findings to undetermined or homicide, we're not going to do anything about it. And then it's just this never ending carousel that you end on, as many cases do. And it's just frustrating and, you know, doesn't get us anywhere. But yeah, want to know your thoughts on this one for sure. Let us know in the comments below. Appreciate you for tuning in today. Ken will be back next week, of course. But yeah, I'm going to wrap up today's episode there. We'll see you next time.